Good morning, Reverend Bain. Do you prefer Mark or Reverend Bain or Reverend Mark?
I like
Mark?
Mark.
Okay. I like Tim too. So, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're in between events right now, and you said you couldn't get into your hotel, which is why you're in your car. But it
Well,
looks like a comfy car. It's what?
I'm in a good spot. I couldn't.
You're
I
in a good spot. It's, yeah.
know.
It looks comfortable, so that's good. We just finished up. What was what now? 2 weeks ago, we had our home fellowship workshop, which you were a part of, and you helped to make it a superb event. So thank you so much for being a part of that. I just wish you could have been around a little longer. I know you had some flight issues there, and it was really a miracle that you were able to to come. But thank you so much for that. And for those of you who aren't familiar with what we did a home fellowship workshop. My congregation, Beth Tikun Messianic Fellowship, has been doing home fellowships for going on 4 years now, and or I guess 4 years now, and we didn't do that before. We were, we met in a building once a week, but there was we reached a point where we knew we needed to take a little more seriously our discipleship, and that wasn't happening to the degree we liked in a building. So we split up into home fellowships. We've been doing it ever since, and none of us had really any good experience with it. So we've been making mistakes, learning lessons over these years, and it was high time for us to kind of circle the wagons, share with each other what we'd learned, bring in some speakers to help inspire, encourage, and equip us. And Mark here was one of those speakers, and he did just that. So it was a great success. I was just reading some feedback yesterday. We finally got feedback on a survey, and it was all very positive.
Good.
There was a few questions, and some additional questions came up, which is what I was hoping for, because I want us to keep this going throughout the year, do an evening here or a weekend there, where we tackle one topic and have someone either come in or Skype in or something to help us answer some questions we have. So it was great. Thank you so much.
It was awesome to be there. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, my pleasure. So you brought some great thoughts to us that Sunday morning. That was on the 12th. And you spoke of the topic of outreach for the small assembly, and did a great job. So thank you again for that. So I want to start off with talking about a little bit more of your experience with specifically with small assemblies, home assemblies, house churches, whatever you want to call it. What has been your how have you engaged with those, and what's been your experience with those?
Well, I've personal experience. I've planted several as the lead pastor of the mother church. In other words, I think the first house church that I was engaged with starting was probably in see 19 probably 1998, 99, and that was in Albuquerque, and it was group of Spanish people from Belize. No, Bolivia. Bolivia. The Belize was another thing. Bolivia, who had come to this country, and it was a family that wanted to have, a church, in their home. And I was engaged in helping them launch that, kick that off, give them some tools and resources on, what to do in that meeting. And they took it from there. I wasn't very much involved after they, kind of launched it. But it was our church that launched it. And then down through the years, I think the every church I've pastored, I've planted a church while I was pastoring it. So I've never, well, I tell people I've always been bivocational. So I've never really been just the pastor of one church, because I just believe that, planting churches is the best way to reach the world, which is kind of my goal. And so I've done a few other things like that. I've planted And each of these started as small assemblies that grew into a little more than a small assembly. I planted four Spanish churches, and all of those started very small. The one that I mentioned back in 98 started as a home church and stayed a home church. They never moved out of their home. It did very well. We started another one with a Spanish group that was a little larger. That was probably, and that was at maybe about 2 years later. In Albuquerque, there might have been 15 or 20 that started there. And they ended up getting a building, moving into more of a prevailing model, kind of a church, you know. And then planted a small assembly in Atlanta, where I pastored at about 15 years ago. 2000 and, that must have been 2011. And it started with like maybe six or seven key leaders, and then it grew, and they became more of a never a Sunday morning type church, but it was a little larger. It grew to about 100 people. The church that I planted a couple of black churches. I have a kind of a heart for marginalized, disenfranchised people. I notice that there's a high population of urban people that are not being reached at all in North America, almost not at all, because they're either Latina or they're black, and most white churches don't do a good job of crossover to try to reach those people groups. So I've always had kind of a
Even
heart.
if there are places within, like if they have proximity to a congregation, you think that's still a problem?
I think Latinos assimilate better into an Anglo congregation than African Americans do. But even at that, their cultural distinction is so unique that most churches have a multi congregational model rather than a multi what's the word? Multi-ethnic, you know, they'll be multi-ethnic, but not in the same building or at the same time. You know, there may be a white congregation, a Sudanese congregation, and a Latina congregation, and a Northern American congregation. So we don't do well at multiculturalism. And when I say we, I'm talking about our tribe, the Church of the Nazarene. And I think it's pretty common with most tribes that we don't reach well people that are not in our homogeneous group. We tend to, and that's kind of a natural thing, obviously.
It's yeah. That's hard. That's hard to break out of.
It's not healthy for the kingdom, but it's natural for us. So I think it's just a little more work. It takes a little more energy and effort to do that. But there's so many pre-Christian people in those cultures that I've just felt the call of God to reach them. So that's why when you hear me talk, most of the plants that I've done in the last 15, 20 years have been multicultural. And mostly they would become multicultural churches. The black churches ended up being somewhat blended. The Latina churches would be somewhat blended. And the Anglo churches that we planted would be somewhat blended. Churches I'm planting here in Gainesville now, there's only maybe somewhere around 18 that might show up on a normal, regular event. But really bad day, we might have eight or nine, and they're somewhat blended. You know, I'm white. There's two other Anglos that are in the group, two Asians, and four to eight African Americans. So I try to make it a priority that we don't just minister to one cultural group, one ethnic group. So that's been that. That's my experience in being involved with, small congregations. Rarely are they house church congregations. So the one that I mentioned earlier, the first one back in 98 was, and stayed a house church. They did never multiply, but it was a good fellowship. I think he wanted to have a place mostly for his family, and they reached a few other people, but it's primarily his family. But in the church that I'm, planting now, it's not in a house, but it's in a small office. You know, we I have a church here that's lent us an office to use free, so we don't worship in a worship center, worship in an office. And that's So that's kind of my background experience in working with small assemblies.
Okay. Something you said early on there was this idea of mother church. How or what kind of authority structure or relationship between other congregations are you do you typically are you typically moving in? Like, is it is there a clear association with the denomination? Or is it a little looser? And then how is the authority parsed out? What's the structure of authority in these groups you've been a part of?
Yeah, well, I would say that any church plant out of a any church plant that's got some uniqueness from a mother church that's more prevailing model is going to have to be a little looser to be effective. I think the uses a good word, a little less, a little less of a heavy hand with the new congregation, a little more freedom and permission. I'm not talking about in morality or ethics or anything or
No,
theology. I'm talking about in
more
practice.
just traditions and customs
What you
of, yeah.
do in the service, when you meet,
Yeah.
that's makes you, even if you don't meet on Sunday morning at 10:30, 11 a.m., you're kind of a freak still in this, so that's one of those things. It's a little loosey-goosey. We don't focus on having a big, huge, never have. I mean, when I pastored large churches and we had a big, huge worship experience and, professional musicians and all that. But, in us in our churches, we don't really have music, much music, if any, on a regular basis in the small church. The one I'm doing now, we had music in the event. My primary objective in the one that we're doing now is disciple making. And I use that language very carefully versus the discipleship. I think disciple making is the commission. Discipleship is something that we've kind of like to use to refer to getting with other believers and growing each other, which is fine. And that's also disciple making. But I use that language because in our tribe, the word discipleship doesn't mean what the scripture teaches that it means. And
Yeah,
our
there's a
tribe,
lot of confusion.
yeah, well, discipleship means
Yeah.
we meet for an hour on Sunday morning for a Bible study. That's disciple.
Right. Well, that's like the same idea of calling the person who is in charge of mowing the grass as part of the lawn ministry.
Right.
It's like, what are we talking about here?
I use that language, discipleship, because I know what it does in our tribe to people's brain. When you use it, they
Yeah.
think we're somehow going to evolve back to a 1 hour Bible study once a week. And I don't use the word when we talk about outreach. I don't usually use the word evangelism, because people, are just frightened by that whole concept in this culture. We've become such an isolated culture. So I use the word, the language of disciple making for both of those.
Yeah.
And but yeah, so I think that's another thing that's unique. And when you ask me what kind of influence the mother church has, we do that. So
And
we're not, we don't think.
with accountability and accountability too, there's something, how do home fellowships or these smaller assemblies handle theological accountability or spiritual accountability and something that others might call doctrinal drift? Just like, I remember when we first started out with doing this. There was some folks I knew from where I used to go to church, who the first question they asked was, "Is there an elder at every home assembly?" Because I think the fear was, you don't want there to be this drift away from the fundamentals or whatever or a lack of accountability. So how would you, how have you seen that addressed, or how would you recommend it to be addressed to?
Well, I think the key to maintaining theological integrity is passing on through disciple making, discipleship, to the leader, the right theology, and trusting them to promote that. And in terms of long-term accountability, if you know, like the churches that I've planted that are small assemblies, we've taught them our theology. You know, we teach them our theology. If someone is that takes over the church as a becomes the leader of that assembly, then I'll want to take them through. We have a course of study in the Church of the Nazarene that teaches them the basic theology, Wesleyan theology. And that's how we've maintained integrity in our small groups. And a person can take classes online to move to the level of ordination. We believe in the Church of Nazarene that a lay person can plant a church, a lay person. Because whenever there's been the real massive movement of God in any culture in history, lay people have been released to do ministry. And so, as a district superintendent, now when I was a district superintendent, we planted churches with staff members who might have had a credential, like they might have a district license or a local license. So we have different levels of responsibility in terms of ministry in our tribe. Local, a layman, then a lay minister, district licensed minister, elder. So we don't think you have to be an elder to plant a church or to lead a church. But we want you to get there. We try to teach you in the process. So if we demanded that everyone who plants a church is an elder, we wouldn't plant many churches.
Or perhaps the qualifications for elder are something that need to be revisited. One thing that came to mind was we kind of made a shift. In when I first started coming to our congregation, I was struck by how there was a what the proper theology was de-emphasized, but how to find the right theology was emphasized. So, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, teach a man to fish, he'll eat the rest of his life. So it was that kind of mentality. So, as I had questions, I came and I'm like, hey, what do I have to believe? What do I got to do? And they were like, no, we're not going to tell you, but we'll show you how to find it so that it can be yours and you can own it. Which I think is probably more in line with what discipleship should look like is here are the tools. I'll teach you how to use the tools because if you use them properly, you're going to find the truth there. And we're not so much worried about you going, off the deep end, as long as we've trained you how to use the right tools. So would you say, just from your perspective, I'm really curious about this. From your perspective, would you say that there is in your tribe, not maybe you, I mean, you can only answer for yourself. So do that, but also if there's a sense from your tribe that there is a either a stated or a presumed goal that smaller assemblies should grow to bigger assemblies and look like the prevailing model. So if your own perspective on that, which I think I know what it is,
Yeah,
but
I can see perspective.
is there a competing perspective too within your tribe? As to what the outcome should be.
Well, that's a cultural perspective that isn't in any of our theology or any of our documents or any of our writings. You know, the cultural model is you're not really successful unless your church gets big. That's USA. You know, that's I completely reject that. I do think that if a church is not reaching lost people, they're probably speaking of theological accuracy and theological integrity. If the church is not missional, it's not the church. If you have five people walking with Jesus for 50 years and no one ever comes to faith, I don't think that church is theologically solid. I think there's something desperately missing. So disciple making or the Great Commission is important. Now, the Great Commission doesn't mean that you're going to grow a big church. I'll give you a quick example. There's a Spanish guy that came to Florida from Puerto Rico about 25 years ago, and he said there was one and a half Spanish churches in Florida, one and a half. He said they gave me the half church, so he had like eight people, right? So he started with a small assembly. He's a really very compassionate, very passionate believer, and he grew his church, you know, fitting into this cultural kind of expectation that you should, you know, you should get bigger. And he grew his church to about 500, and he said the Holy Spirit spoke to him and said, I don't want you to pastor a big church. I want you to reach a lot of people. So he started training and equipping leaders and sending them out to plant churches. Today, his church only runs about 250, but there are 36 Spanish churches in Florida that he has equipped leaders to send out for every one of them. So he really pastors essentially probably 3,000 people because of his influence. And so I would say, in terms of the church growth, I think the church growth movement has been has had a devastating impact on the kingdom of God.
Can you go through what you're defining as a church growth movement? Can you define that?
Church growth movement, get more people in, grow bigger, get bigger buildings, have great worship, have the best teacher, have the best youth department, the best children's department. Everything's professional, sharp, everything is great.
Attractional model, I think I've heard it called.
User-friendly, seeker sensitive, all those things kind of fit into that whole church growth movement. And what the problem with it, in my perspective, is that when you focus on those things, the people that come to your church are believers that are disgruntled from their churches. Lost people don't particularly want to come to a place like that. And I can tell you stories. I mean, there was a church in Kansas City. I had an office there, and I lived there for 4 years before I came to Florida. And there was a church there, Craig Rochelle's church, Life Church, is it, I think. They planted a church, and within 5 years, they had 2,000 people. And I could go over there, and I would know 200 of those people. 200 of them were Nazarenes from Nazarene churches that wanted a better children's program, a better youth program, or better music, or didn't want to be discipled. They just wanted to go to church on Sunday. And so they chose that over the others. Alan Hirsch talks a lot about this. He says that like 40 to 60% of the churches in North America are competing for the same people from other churches. And so that's why I say that I think the church has hurt us, because it de-emphasized evangelism, and it emphasized corporate structures that are attractive.
Or it emphasized outreach, but once people were reached and brought in, they were sent back out to do more outreach, but not discipled, right? Like they were being attracted to something that lacked the substance that was needed. At least that's been some of my experience was you bring them in, but you're not shown or taught how to be a disciple. You're just kind of turned right back around to go back out and keep bringing more people in. Like that's I see that happening to a degree. Not universally, but that can happen, and it's
Absolutely. Yeah.
and the opposite can happen
Talk to those
too.
leaders. If you talk to the leaders of those churches that we're talking about, that would just break their heart. They would say, no, you don't understand. We're all about discipleship. That's all we want to do is see people grow in Jesus. That's really, but the form of the structure they're building is attractional to that group. And so, yeah. And when you say not to bring more, teach them to bring people to the church. Yeah, that's true.
And that's certainly not that's the exception rather than the rule. It could also go the opposite way too, where you can I think like you can and you alluded to this in the example of a group that's been meeting for 50 years but hasn't grown. There are no new people. Like clearly they're missing the mark
Yeah,
there.
the problem.
But you can have these people come together, and it's the same people for 20 years who really know a lot about the word. They really know, you know, they know how to live out the life of a believer, but they're pretty much just relying on God alone to bring them people when Jesus clearly said, "Go and do it." Like you got a stake in this too. Go do it. So it can be the other side too, where you're pouring into some people, and it's something great, but you're not bringing anybody else in, and so you got to find some balance. And that was one of the big takeaways for me in this conference, was how to establish some balance in our congregation, because I feel like we're a pretty smart bunch. We are, we delve into the Hebrew a lot, into the Greek some, and I know a lot of people probably do that too. But we've got a pretty cerebral bunch too. Because we're messianic, we are not the popular choice. We're not gonna, people didn't come to this congregation because they wanted to do the cool thing. It's, we're too Christian for the Jews, and we're too Jewish for the Christians. And so you gotta, if you're gonna be here, it's because you found something special. At the same time, it also attracts some introverted people, people who like to kind of be anonymous and disappear. Not to say that that's the kind of people we have, but that can be attractive to those types. So anyway, how to balance that with some, okay, let's be a little more outward focused. Let's really consider, let's look, have we grown? Like how much? Like it's not a it's it's. We don't particularly count our members. We don't keep track. People ask me, how big is your congregation? I'm like, maybe over 100, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not counting. But there is some, there, it does make some sense to look and go, okay, how many new households have come into our congregation over the past year? Like that's not a bad question to ask.
And
So
we have that
going,
all the time in our churches, and we have groups of people. When I was at Atlanta First Church, that was the last church I pastored before I became a DS. And there was a class of people, about 65 people, that were very cerebral, very intelligent. They got very deep in the word and were very solid Christians, good in every way. They would be great neighbors to have. They're the kind of people you'd want to have in your neighborhood, all that. And they asked me to come do a workshop on evangelism for them. And so I did. I'd only been their pastor for about a year. And I talked about disciple making. And one of the guys said, "Well, Pastor, it sounds like me. You don't love us. You just love lost people." And I said, "Well, I love all people. I love you and I love lost people." I didn't say what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, "Well, it sounds like you love you, but I don't love lost people, you know." But so ultimately what happened was the teacher of that group, who was a patriarch of that church. He was solid. He led that church, that group, for probably I don't know, 30 years. And at the end of that, he said, he didn't say, but one of the leaders in the group said it. Maybe it was their president, I don't know. He said, "You know, new people, young Christians, would not be comfortable in our church, in our fellowship." He meant fellowship. He said, "Because we go deep, and new Christians are not deep enough theologically to feel comfortable. They would feel out of place in our fellowship." And I said, and I still believe it today. I said, "If you're so deep that new believers are uncomfortable, you're shallow. You're thinking about yourself. You're not thinking about lost people." They didn't care for that. But what happened, the end result, that teacher called me and said, "I'd like for you to have breakfast with me in the morning. I want to talk to you." And I don't think I told this story when I spoke, but I usually tell this story when I talk about this. I just didn't know your context, so I probably didn't use it. But I met him the next morning, and he said, "I don't think I've ever had a pastor who said anything more offensive to my to my fellowship than you did last night, and you're our pastor. He said, we're really struggling with knowing how to process that. And then he started weeping and crying. I mean, uncontrollably. He said, thank you for being honest with us. He said, I'm so tired of coming every Sunday and these same people want deeper, deeper, deeper stuff in the word. He said, but for what purpose? Why are they becoming spiritually mature? So they can just be fat Christians? He said, I want to leave this class and start a new Christians class. I'm tired of this. And I told him, I said, Eddie, decaf, bro, I need you to stay there. Thank you for there and help move them. But that was an experience I had that's pretty common way of thinking in many of our churches. So, that's not uncommon.
So going a little farther into the this the context where you have of being, in leadership of a global denomination, how is there any question about autonomy in these groups? Like how autonomous are some of these small assemblies or church plants or whatever, and are they necessarily affiliated or associated with your denomination?
Hold on, I'm getting up and something I need to share with you that will help, I think, answer that question.
Okay,
I'm
cool.
opening up my computer, sorry.
No, it's okay. And then there's another question too, because we moved into this home fellowship model where we are a collection of nine home fellowships that are associated as a congregation, as a larger fellowship. But we have no association beyond that. We're not part of any messianic alliance, MJAA or UMJC, anything like that. We're not part of any of that. We are completely autonomous as a collection of home fellowships. And we did that. We moved in that direction after being, a weekly meeting with, everyone there, all the elders, leadership, lay people, and whatnot. And the question of autonomy within these groups has come up too. And it's been years of us trying to figure out what's this, how does the structure work, who's leading who, what responsibilities do each of the leaders of these groups have, what authority do they have to make decisions, how do we stay connected and keep them accountable, and all that. And it's been in that area. I mean, we're all still new to this even after a few years. But it's always helpful to look at some other groups to see how they're structuring it, while also making sure we're in the word and see how it was structured as set out in the New Testament and the Old Testament. But go ahead and share what you were going to share.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I'm going to read you what our definition of a church is. So in the Church of the Nazarene, we have a specific definition, which if read to most Nazarenes for the first time, they would rebel against it. But our definition, and it's kind of loose on purpose. It's any group that meets regularly, and regularly is an important word. Strategic, it means it has to be planned. You don't just haphazardly have a meeting whenever it feels good. It'll be something you're actually thinking about processing. So any group that meets regularly for spiritual nurture, worship, or instruction with an identified leader. It doesn't say elder, doesn't say ordained person, doesn't say a licensed minister. An identified leader, that's the really loose part of it that Nazarenes wouldn't like. Aligned with the message and the mission of the Church of Nazarene, may be recognized as a church and reported as such for district and general church statistics. So that's kind of our definition of a church. And if someone fits that definition, we will talk to them about becoming a Nazarene church. Now we would say there's, a couple of sacraments that you should not, practice without an elder or a district licensed minister. When you become a district licensed minister, you're able to share, practice the what's the word? My brain lost the word. Communion, baptism, marriage. There's a word for that. My brain just lost it.
Sacraments or
Sacraments. And so in a church and that's new, that has a layman leading it, we would come alongside them and pretty quickly try to get them involved so that they could get to the place where they could do those things. Until then, we would say, whenever you're having communion or baptism, we would love to come and be there. Just be present. Don't have to be involved, just to have an elder present to help you through to make sure that these things are done in a biblical, theologically solid way. I don't know if that helps, but that's
No, that is helpful. So there's if there are some people who would be uncomfortable with the seemingly loose boundaries of that definition, do you find that in the Nazarene church there is any misconceptions or criticisms about home assemblies that you've heard or that you maybe dispelled, like, oh, no, like this is good, like this is we see this in the early believing community, and do you come across that very much?
Sure. Well, I believe that the way I believe, as Hirsch does, that the way to do our faith is much better done in a small assembly than it is a big assembly. It's much better done in an environment where people can be human versus superficial and 1 hour a week. I do not make a disciple 1 hour a week. I don't think that will happen. So you need to be in their lives. And so I think it's, the answer is, there's pushback on churches that do this. And here's the pushback. When people don't push back on small assemblies, they don't push back on house churches. They push back on something that's only exclusively for a small group forever. That's what troubles people in our tribe. Tell me one time, well, we waste so much money on worship, so much money on music. And he had been a pastor. He said, we just meet on Sunday morning in my living room. I turn on the TV, we watch a good preacher, we pray, and we go home. Well, that would be resisted by many of our DSs, district superintendents, because there's no sense of accountability. He's not putting in any effort to try to make that an effective event. And it's all about his family and maybe one other family exclusively. So we have that. There's people that, the first time I read that definition was at a district superintendent's leadership event, and we were doing round tables. So there might have been 12 or 15 district superintendents at my table, and my opening comments about church planting was to read this definition, and they were mortified by this definition. Mortified. What do you mean? We don't have any authority over that person, their layperson, and we don't have the privilege to pull the rip their credentials if they don't act right. And the anything that hinders the multiplication of God's kingdom is a problem. But that's changed. That was like 6 years ago, and they're kind of embracing the idea now. So yeah, that's true. That does happen. Yeah, there's pushback.
In my interview with Dr. Wadsworth, at the end, I had asked him, are there any questions that he wishes people would ask? And he said, basically, he was talking about what kind of encouragement or advice he would give to pastors in an age of increasing interests, which I believe it's increasing interest. I don't know the numbers, but in an age of increasing interest in smaller assemblies where a professional minister or pastor is not necessarily needed, because
Not necessarily.
Yeah, and he wanted to encourage them, and you'll have to watch the video. I meant to watch it last night before I went to bed, but I forgot to review what exactly he said. But that's something too. Like, there's some fear there. Even when I took this job, we were already into this model of home fellowship, and I was the first full-time paid leader of the congregation, even though my predecessor had been doing it for 27 years. He was never fully paid. He was retired, and he was, I think he was getting, a stipend or something like that. But I was the first full time coming into this as a group of home assemblies, and realizing, like, oh, like I don't I, I'm I question at times, like, am I really even needed as a full time person? And anytime I think of that, it's terrifying. Right? So there's some fear there, I think, from some folks who are like, okay, my calling was to be a minister, a pastor, to lead a congregation, and I've got a family. Like, if I'm to embrace this idea of smaller assemblies, that changes so much about what I do, or it eliminates my position altogether. But he was, and I think you would probably say the same thing, he was encouraging them to basically, don't be afraid of this. Like, don't be afraid, embrace it. There will always be a need for someone who has the knowledge you have and the experience you have and the heart you have. But anyway, I don't know if you wanted to add to that, but I thought that was
Yeah,
very fitting.
I think Jesus wasn't needed after 3 years, and he was okay
Right.
with it. And I think if the model that Jesus, gave us of disciple making is implemented in our culture, then the best leaders are leaders that are going to work themselves out of a job and do it somewhere else, make disciples elsewhere. Paul certainly modeled that in Acts. He never stayed anywhere more than what the longest stay was 2 years, in one place. So, I mean, to answer that specific question, professional ministry, that is, that we're paid for, my sense is that that is a model that's becoming less and less valued in our culture. Not that people don't want to pay their pastors, it's not that. Just in small assemblies, it's not, if you have a very small assembly, you're not going to get paid, and
Right.
for
You
that.
got it. You got to have a kind of a situation where I have, which is we're still a fellowship. We're a fellowship of fellowships. And so I don't know if it's in the aggregate. So in the accumulation, there's the potential for supporting a full-time person and his family. But I mean, what we're doing is unusual. It's not typical. And most people are just starting their house churches or home fellowships just as a family, one family who just reacting against the prevailing model or whatever reason, and they do it. And yeah, so it's very interesting.
Yeah, you were talking about credibility in terms of being larger. There's more cred in terms of being larger than there is being small. A cultural phenomenon that we experience. I think there's also a cultural phenomenon that we experience that says the more you get paid, the better you are at it. And I think that's been one of the driving, I mean, that's one of the driving forces that's kind of helped create this monstrosity that we have, I think that may be one of the reasons why some of the younger people are kind of turned away from, this, but bivocational ministry, co-vocational becomes more of a trend. Now, I'm not saying it's happened yet, but it seems to be happening. And I don't think they want to be autonomous. I don't think it's because they don't want to have anyone having authority over them. I think it's just because they want to be like Paul, and they want to be a tent maker. I've been paid by the church my whole life, and I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying there's a new move in I think in the kingdom in North America, where you're going to be more effective at bivocational or co-vocational than you would be if you were just single vocationally a pastor. I had a pastor in Joplin, Missouri, in the district I was at. that grew a church. He was the art teacher for high school in a little big town in Missouri. I mean, like a little town. And he started a church, and the church grew to like 250 people. It's like a country church. It was like a big, small group. It's just these people were so uniquely unique that there's probably no other church they would have wanted to go to. And I remember after I'd been as district superintendent for about 3 years, he said, "I think I'm going to retire from the high school." And I said, "Have you really thought about what that would mean? How much time and energy and resource you can invest in this church to see it continue to, to move forward?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Have you also thought of whether or not you would have any contact with pre-Christians at all if you left your job and just exclusively went to the church?" Because I would say 80% of the people in that congregation were at some level a reflection of his ministry in his school job. And he decided not to retire. He's still teaching there. He can hardly hear. I think he's in his early 80s. But he said, "Man, if I stop doing that, I'm never going to talk to any lost people ever. And I need to have that contact." So there's that. That's the kind of a move that's happening, I think, in North America, in small groups, small fellowships, micro churches, fresh expressions of church. The idea is, let's do. I want to stay involved in the world around me and reach those people that I'm reaching in my community, while I have a fellowship that doesn't have to have a lot of money to effectively run.
Right. I think, yeah, that's such a great story. There's language matters. The words we use matter. And it seems to me like if we're examining this right, it seems to me that maybe the shift is from a church planting, which is, I don't know how many decades old now of an idea, from church planting to disciple making, and it's not a dramatic shift, right? It's a difference in language, because if you're talking about planting a church, there's maybe this connotation of an organization or an entity that is not made up of people, right? But if we're talking about disciple making, we're talking about something that would, in most to most circles and denominations, precede the foundation of a church or an organization. So it's like going deeper, getting more to the core of what it is we're doing, and then seeing, oh, and by the way, that's actually what Jesus told us to do. He didn't tell us to go and make churches.
Don't
He
build
told us
buildings.
to make disciples. So again, language, I think, is important here. And I know you would agree. And even we have our terminology in our congregation and in our circles too, of things like, using terms like you just did, a micro church or fresh expressions or things like that. Like these are all ways in which we can describe stuff that, fresh expressions is something I think that I've never heard outside of of. Is it the Fresh Expressions was what someone denomination was
Well,
that
the
Michael
United
Beck was a part of?
Michael Adam Beck in the United Methodist Church
United
wrote,
Methodist Church.
yeah,
Right.
and
Okay.
wrote
So I think, yeah, so I think that,
Wild Branches.
yeah, so I think that Fresh Expressions was, so I actually have a marketing background. Before I became this full-time minister a couple of years ago, I was in marketing and creative direction, graphic design,
Okay.
content writing, all this stuff, right? And so when I hear some of the stuff, I pick up on that sounds like a marketing term. And it maybe inadvertently, maybe a group is like, oh, we've got to call it something different, because maybe there's still a remnant of this attractional model. We got to make it sound more interesting. And but we keep shooting ourselves in the foot, because we're not getting back to just a simple personal, interpersonal, face-to-face interactions of making disciples. And I'm encouraged by like these conversations and the home fellowship conference we had, and a lot of other stuff I'm seeing online, of just shedding this extra dressing on top of things that complicates it and maybe makes it more of a needlessly competitive landscape. Like, oh, you need to be a disciple in our church because we've got it all together. and then, of course, they quickly find out, no, you don't have it all together. But do you see what I'm saying?
What you said a minute ago about disciple making versus church planting, or not versus, but they're somewhat level competitive with each other. Any effective, productive church planting movement that I know is not big church. It's not prevailing model. It's,
Sure.
they would say, and most of the people who write about it would say, if you make disciples, you will plant churches. It will happen. In other words, you will plant the gospel in places where people are going to gather together to learn about it, follow Jesus, which is what a church is, a gathering of people who are doing their faith in their world. Those people that have been effective at it would say, if you make disciples, you're going to plant churches, but you can plant churches without disciples. And that's
Yeah.
been kind of the trend, I think, in a lot of the church planting movement that I've seen.
And I think that has to do with language. I honestly think it has to do with language. Don't stop calling it church planting. Call it disciple making, and the church planting will happen.
Yeah, I like that. I do that.
I listened to a great author recently, and his name is Derek Sivers, who wrote Useful Not True. Well, he wrote a few little books, Useful Not True. I don't believe he's a believer, but his book touched on how we believe lies, right? So sometimes we believe a lie because it's useful, right? There are some useful lies that help us to navigate relationships or deal with pain or fear or stress, and some things we just have to, how we have to describe what's going on might not be true, but is useful. So that's beside the point. But he also did this great talk once on stop talking about your goals, stop sharing your goals, and this has to do with this question about church planting versus disciple making. So if I set a goal for myself that is about a changed future, that's a terrible goal. A good goal is a goal that changes me right now. For example, if I said, I've told some people recently, and I'm confessing this as a bad goal. I've told people that I'll be 48 this year. By the time I'm 50, I'm going to be in the best shape of my life. Good goal, right? You would think. It's
Well,
actually a terrible goal. A, because it's talking about the future, about something that could be accomplished. And I just shared it with people. And in the sharing of a goal, there's something that's called substitution, where we start to feel like we've achieved it. We get positive feedback, we get a rush of endorphins or whatever. And it's like, oh, okay. And then nothing changes about my present. A better goal related to that is, if someone were to ask me, do you have any goals? I'm like, yes, I'm going to bust my butt 3 days a week in the gym.
yeah.
Very different goal, but it has more to do with the present, and it will produce probably me being in the best shape of my life at 50. And I can keep that goal to myself. But this I see is maybe what's going on with church planting versus disciple making. Church planting is something that is big and it's off in the distance, but it doesn't necessarily affect your present moment. Whereas disciple making is smaller, it's more immediate because I'm around people all the time. I'm not around potential churches all the time, right? So there may be something there too of, and this is a great side topic of from what we were talking about, but language matters so much, and I wish we would stop talking about church planting or even using words like micro church. No disrespect to you and your use of it, but it's or even in our fellowship, we don't even use the word church. And I could we could have a long conversation about that, about what that word, how that word originated, and that there's no Aside from the word priest in scripture, there's no other religious terminology in all of scripture, Hebrew and Greek. And when we use this word church with English speakers, we're bringing a religious connotation to it that was never present in the New Testament. When we talk about the words for assembly, they were just, you could have an ecclesia of plumbers. It's
Well,
just
if
a
you
gathering.
from a contemporary perspective, Jesus said, "I will build my church, and
Well,
gates of hell."
but he didn't, it wasn't a religious perspective, a religious, it didn't have a religious connotation to it. It was just a gathering of people, his assembly of people.
That's
So
exactly.
it was all very common language. And so I've trained myself over the years not to use the word church. I mean, I still use it just because that's what people know.
Sure,
But
yeah.
if I'm starting from zero, I'll say assembly or fellowship, or even congregation has some religious connotation to it. So all that to say, words matter, and the words we choose, it's like we use words to accomplish some things, but over time, words tend to use us because they change the way we think. And so making sure we're intentional about the words we use and the effects those words have on us and our understanding and our thinking, I think is something that a lot of people are waking up to or coming to a realization of. But
Even that can become cumbersome. I'm gonna make
yeah,
sure
it's hard to do.
words that don't have the wrong meaning. I'm gonna spend my life focused on, not saying the wrong words.
Right,
Unless you're
yeah.
disciples, I'm with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like in our conversations, I've said the word church a million times. So it's like, you got to pick your battles, but in my own to make sure that I'm thinking correctly, I, for my own benefit, need to be using certain words over others. And especially if we're talking about church planning and disciple making. Like disciple making, that's something that anybody can do.
Yes.
Church planning is something, it's other, it's something bigger, it's something more formal, it's something, or at least there's that connotation to it, or the feeling of it being something that is that you got to be qualified for, which isn't true, but because of the language, it creates its own barrier there
And cultural
for
language,
actual.
does it. Yeah, when I say the word church, I'm not thinking about a building. I'm not thinking about a gathering of
Right.
something. I'm thinking about a group of people that are coming together to do their faith in a community,
Yeah. Yeah.
So
And
that's
yeah.
me, but it does it to the culture. Yeah, I
Yeah.
get
And th and that's why I know that I can use that word with you, and we
that.
have the same
Yeah.
understanding of it.
Finding that in our tribe, or people will, anytime you use the word, you're right. That's why
Yeah.
we have to make that definition. And it's not, this is not a building. He didn't say go build a building. He didn't say go have Sunday school class or go have a worship experience where there's three instruments and five praise team members. Go make disciples.
Yeah. I want to shift gears here before we wrap up. This has been a great conversation, by the way. I really enjoyed this. When you came and spoke, you did a topic outreach for the small assembly. And one of the questions that came out of that, or something that I had written down, was like, I want to ask him a little bit more about this, was related to the difference between outreach from a prevailing model approach to a small assembly approach. And the main difference being in the prevailing model of weekly church gatherings in a big building with a lot of people, it's a public space where questions of security and safety can be addressed on a large scale. So it's a place where people can come in and be vetted before sending them into a more intimate personal space like someone's home. We experienced something kind of like this a couple of years ago, where there was a family that was interested. It was I think a single mom and kids. I can't remember what it was, but a family that wanted to come in, and immediately they were just routed to a home fellowship in that area, with no getting to know them, no vetting or anything like that. And it didn't work out And it caused some stress because the people in that home fellowship were basically being told by leadership, take this person in. They did it, so they were obedient to authority, but authority didn't do a great job of making sure that that was a good fit. That's not a problem that happens in the prevailing model, right? So it's trade-off, right? It's a,
Prayer.
sometimes it can't, right? But
I've had an
it's
urban ministry, and you could have all kind of characters come and do a corporate worship service that could just blow it up. But yeah, you're right.
but yeah, but that, like, people are much less concerned about that blowing up than they would be about something blowing up in the privacy of their own home, right? That there's a big difference. So my question to you would be, like, how, I don't know if you even have any thoughts about this, but I think it's something that's worth talking about. How do small assemblies balance the intimacy, close-knit relationships, safety, security, while also remaining open to new members? And is there, I can think of a vetting process. We've tried it here, where we have a small group that meets at a building. So one of the groups actually meets at the building every week, and that's the place. I'm there, and another elder will be there. That's where we encourage new people to come for a time, and then after we get to know them, we recommend they go to one of these other home fellowships. But the idea is protect the safety and integrity of these smaller groups that are getting to know each other on a very deep personal level, that on a way that doesn't happen in a big public assembly. You see what I'm saying? So, like, there's a difference there in outreach, in how you approach it and how it progresses in order to bring people in. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if safety and security is a priority, you have to decide what that priority is, how much risk you're going to take. I think that's the first question you have to ask. How much risk am I willing to take in my home? And if you say I don't want anybody coming to my home that would hurt my family, that would steal my stuff. Okay, if that's your level, then you would have to make disciples outside of that environment until they got to the place where you felt like that they were safe for you. If you were to say, man, I'm gonna invite somebody that seems to be interested in Jesus into my home and trust God to protect us, then you would have a different level of what you would like to have someone vet, how well you want to vet someone for that. My wife, for me to have people in my home, I have to really tell her a little bit about them, explain the where they're at in their faith and their development, how safe they would be. And I'll confess, I probably brought some characters in that she wasn't real sure of. I wasn't, but I felt led. I think there's a Holy Spirit part of this that you can't really write down. But if I mean, I think you have to
Or
decide.
there's a you mean like a trust part of it?
Got to decide your own fellowship. I'd let anybody in my house because my feeling is if I got something in my house that matters more to me than their soul, I need to get rid of it. If I'm worried about them stealing, I need to get rid of it. Now, safety, hurting my family or something like that, takes it to another level, but didn't seem to affect Jesus too much to get hurt for his faith. So all those things are kind of, I don't know that a home fellowship. I guess what I would say is if I were to answer that question, I would say you need to have levels of spiritual development outside of your home before, if those are your qualifiers, before you bring them. Now, I'm not judging whether they're right or wrong. I'm just saying whatever they are, whatever level of trust you want to have for people, then you have to have a lower level for the people that you're reaching, because if you're going to reach really lost people, you're not going to trust them to come into your home at first, unless they're like, I mean, there are some people you would, but if you're reaching really lost people, you're asking for some, it's messy. It's messy to reach lost people. So What I do in terms of my home is I'll see someone come to faith, watch them grow spiritually in our corporate, our meeting at the church before I invite them in our home, and I think that's discipleship. So I think you just have to find the balance for what your criteria for safety and security and protection are, and operate within the realm of that. I think that's what you how you have to build it.
I think there's balance to be found, and we can definitely err if we can err on the side of being too cerebral and getting too deep and not having it be approachable. We can also err on the side of, well, we really need to protect and maintain the integrity here, so rarely anybody knew because we don't want to mess with that, this thing that we built. Which gets into another topic of, is God even interested in the things we build, or is he more interested in the things that he builds? And how much do we trust him to be building these things? On the topic of that, I'm just reminded of something that Matt Dabbs shared in one of his sessions on the Saturday of our conference, and it was these five questions in how you could vet someone before bringing them into your assembly or your small assembly, or even take them on as a disciple. I think is what his what this criteria is for. I could be wrong on this on the latter part, but at least as far as whether or not they're safe enough for the group that they're coming into. And it's these questions here. It's, is this person teachable? Is this person selectively humble? Is this person consistent in how they treat the least of these? So watch how they treat the waitress and the server and the people who are serving them. Can they see when they're wrong? And can they apologize? So these are, to him, these are kind of good indicators. You just kind of taking inventory, like, okay, this person is someone who's going to be humble. They're not going to come in. They're not going to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. They're not going to come in and try to stir the pot. They're genuinely, God has prepared them in a way to be where we are, and so we'll trust him. But these were kind of some of the markers he had made it a point to observe in people.
Well, that to me, when I hear you ask those questions, if that becomes a criteria we use, then you're probably not going to get many non-believers in your fellowship. You're going to have to reach them for Christ and disciple them before they come into your home, because non-believers are not very humble, because the essence of faith is selflessness, and humility is completely counter to that for lost person. I think each of those is, though there's a new, you probably heard this, new philosophy out there that you hear talked about in churches when they're trying to grow their church. They're trying to dig their way back into being authentically missional as a prevailing model church, right? When you meet somebody that's pastoring a prevailing model church and they wake up and they say, "Wait a minute, something's wrong here. Seems like all we're reaching is believers." And they're coming from other churches or from small groups or home churches or whatever. And we need to reevaluate if we're being effective. I think any pastor, whatever type church he's, if he's pastoring an assembly that's 10 people or 10,000 people, if he has any integrity at all, or she, they want to do it right. They really, want to do it right. So when you find people like that, they've shifted their mission, because what you just said would be the criteria that the guy that I met in that senior adult class that I spoke to that said they go deep. That would be their qualifiers for having someone in their class. They would own, that would be something they'd say, yeah. And not in their home, but in their church. They wouldn't want anybody in their church that's dangerous or risky. And so one of the things that's shifted that you hear a lot about when you read about, what's happening in the church, the church today, is they need to belong before they believe. Belong before they believe. Because people come into a fellowship, everything is different, everything's unique. And we want to make them fit into our structures and all of our cultural norms before they even believe. And what we do by that is we teach people how to be Christian without being Christian. We teach them to the premises and the parameters without having a heart change. And that creates churchmen, but not people of God. So that would be one of the dangers of that. But I mean, there's no difference between what you just said about a small assembly and many prevailing model churches I've been at. If you want to define what the qualifiers are, I mean, I've had people leave my church because I brought homeless people in and fed them, and they stayed for worship. They actually left my church because they weren't worried about having anything stolen. They might have, but that wasn't their primary motive. They were worried that they didn't want to smell that. They didn't want to have to smell that sitting next to them in church. We removed the pews from our church and put chairs in.
It's a good thing you did that then, because those folks maybe should not have been there
probably
in the
not.
First place.
Yeah, but you know, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's the tension.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think in every assembly, that there's that tension. You have to decide, you know, so can they belong before they believe? Is that the right? Is that right? Is that accurate to say that? Is that even what we want? I'm not sure I want that, but I do want people to know that they're loved before they believe. I don't want them to act like me. Paul makes it very clear. You know, you're not going to don't act like a Christian. You either are or you're not. And if you say you are, you better live it. You know, Corinthians 1 and 2, the guy that had sex with his father's wife, you know, if you profess yourself to be a believer, I expect certain things out of you, but I don't expect certain things out of you if you're not a believer. So if we're going to be serious about mission, I'm just saying we have to be willing to take some risks. Now, those risks you have to be willing to take in your fellowship, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think too, if I remember correctly, this list of questions, it's probably that if one of these is true, that may be enough. It wouldn't be that, okay, does he or she meet all of these, tick off all these boxes, like, okay, they can be teachable, they're humble, they are kind to lesser people of lesser station, you know, can they admit when they're wrong? Are they, yeah. So like, but you're absolutely right though. How high is this bar for us, and how much are we not trusting that God will bring to us the people who need what we have?
Now, I'm not convinced that you can attain those qualities without faith in Jesus. I think those qualities come through Jesus. The morality and ethic comes through a relationship, through an encounter with God. You know, I was not a very kind person. I would hurt people. I'd, you know, stab people. I'd fight people before I became a Christian. I could have put on that I was kind when I was around church people. I knew how to act nice. You know, I could do that, but it was more of a game for me. And so I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that. All I'm saying is, for your fellowship, you have to decide what those parameters are and then live with them, you know? Yeah. And if that's the parameter, then you might need an entry level group, you know, like a group for people that are recovering from drugs or something that you may not
want. Or it's a prerequisite or a step before this of, okay, here's someone who, you know, might be a good to be in our group. I'm going to go and meet with them for dinner a few times. You know, we're going to pray together. We're going to like maybe do something a little more one-on-one so that I can discern, because what we want is we want people who come into these home assemblies, just like people who are coming into any church, we want them to feel that they're going to be safe there.
Right.
And by setting up these boundaries and certain expectations, yes, it can be a kind of barrier for certain people, but maybe that person who's new there wouldn't have wanted the version of him from a year ago to be present because he knows that, man, I was not a good dude. I'm glad that I would not have been allowed in here because I don't want folks like that coming in here at that stage of their development. God needs to be working on them a little more before bringing me into the picture and helping the process along. So these boundaries.
Find that parameter for yourself and for your
Absolutely. Yeah.
And still, you still read people, but and it might not be a bad idea when you have lunch with that person or coffee, the third or fourth coffee, say, man, we have this home group, and you know, it's a place, it's a safe place where our kids come and where we live and we gather. And we want to make sure that it's a safe place. And can I share with you some of the things we'd like that, that we think are important for people that come to this fellowship? And do you feel like you're at the place where you could do that? I mean, it's kind of like a contract, you know, covenant, right? That may be something you could do. And someone that may not be ready would probably, you know, may be willing to make some adjustments. But the other side of that, the challenge of that is then somehow we end up building churchmen instead of Christians. And that's happened in the prevailing model church. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, I think this goes back to our conversation earlier about the difference between disciple making and church planting. Like the goal, the goal in our fellowships should not be to get people into the fellowships. The goal should be making disciples. And maybe that only happens with me going and having lunch with this guy. Maybe he's never invited into this home fellowship setting because in our particular one, we've got some small kids and maybe this, it just wouldn't be a good fit, but we can't be relying on the quality or a necessity of this kind of home fellowship for everybody. Certainly we shouldn't be veering from the goal of making disciples. It's not about growing our home fellowships in number. It's about growing our home fellowships in quality of disciples. You know, are you growing as a person? Not is your group growing in size? Which is the same problem we've had forever.
I'd put one of the criterias down for what is a disciple. Probably the number one criteria is that person making disciples? Is that person doing the Great Commission? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's got to be part of our definition of a disciple, not just getting deep and learning the word, but doing the one thing Jesus commissioned us to do. But I'm just going to say in all of my ministries, I don't think there's ever been a time, even in a church, even Jesus. I mean, Jesus had a thief and a rebel among his little small group for the whole time he was on the planet. I mean, Judas was there and he allowed him in and it was kind of risky, you know, but he knew, and the thing about Jesus was he knew this about Judas. Mm-hmm. Of course we can go into, you know, well, that was prophesied. So that's a unique experience. Well, they lived that experience. You know? Oh, anyway, well, that's another time, another talk.
Yeah. Another thing, I was having a great conversation with a couple folks yesterday. And I had an epiphany. I'm probably not the first person to come up with this understanding, but we were talking about different experiences we've had with being mentors or being mentored, and it dawned on me something to consider about discipleship is anyone, and I need to eventually qualify this and look and see if this is really true, but I'll just go ahead and throw it out there. Anyone who is moving forward in following Yeshua is someone who can be followed, right?
If they're ahead of you, you mean?
Right. And all discipleship is, as far as those relationships, is if I'm looking for someone to disciple me, I shouldn't be looking for someone who I think has arrived at the destination. I need to be looking for someone who's just a few steps ahead of me. And they may be only a few steps ahead of me in a certain aspect, right? Also, as a discipler, I shouldn't think that, oh, I'm not qualified yet to disciple anybody. I haven't arrived at this status or destination or whatever. It's like if I'm moving forward in my relationship with Yeshua, there is room behind me for someone to follow and be discipled by me in some way. Sure. And so like the bar or the weight and enormity of being a disciple maker kind of diminishes, like, oh, it's actually accessible to anybody who is as long as they're moving forward on this continuum, right? Because if you're following someone presumes movement. If you're not moving, you're just looking at each other. But if I'm moving forward in my relationship and my discipleship, my being discipled by the master, then there's automatically room for someone to be following me, and I can pour into that person. So that was helpful to me. Like, oh, okay, this is actually attainable for more people, and it's not this big intimidating thing of like, oh, how many disciples have you made? Okay, what that actually means is, who have you just helped do something little in moving them forward in their relationship with Yeshua?
Of course, Paul
That
said,
was.
follow me as I follow Christ. He didn't say, follow me, as I try to reach for some perfect
Because that's not
perspective,
real.
livelihood. Follow me as I'm following. It's a living
Yeah.
relationship. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I do.
Great.
Hey, I just got my text. I can go to my room and get some rest.
Okay, great.
And
You've
I've been
earned
waiting
it.
for them to tell me they'll let me in. They were full last night, so.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for your time. And I'll pray continued blessing as you do good work there, and as you travel. And I hope that you get home soon to your lovely bride. So yeah, bless
See you
you,
tomorrow afternoon.
Mark.
Thank you. And let's stay in touch.
Okay, will do.
All right. Bless you, Tim. Have a
All
great
right.
day. Time.
Okay, bye.
We'll see you. Bye-bye.